Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Those of you who journeyed to Indianapolis, have you recovered from your journey yet? I hope so. Most people I spoke with spent the night in Indianapolis. I actually did speak with a couple of people who drove back to East Lansing following the game. I guess that question is geared more to those folks than to those of you who just went to a nice, warm, comfortable hotel room in Indianapolis late on Saturday night. But anyway, an exhilarating Saturday night at Lucas Oil Field for Michigan State University fans. We'll talk with Current Sports Al Martin coming up later this hour. Also, Detroit country music. How often do you associate country music with the city of Detroit? Arguably, you think you link other kinds of music to Detroit, probably, if you're like most people, before you think of country. But there's more to that story, and we will dive into that here before the hour is through. At the top of our program, with just a few days left in the 2013 legislative session, the Michigan House is working its way through a cluster of controversial proposals. Our next guest plays a key role in several of them. One package of bills calls for significant education reforms, including a plan to hold back Michigan third graders who aren't reading at that level. Another would impose a letter grading system on school districts statewide. Yet another addresses the regulation of so-called issue ads. The bills are before the House Education and Ethics, House Education and Ethics and Elections Committees, and conveniently enough, Republican State Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons chairs both. Welcome to Current State.
Hi, Mark. Good morning. You get a twofer with this one.
I absolutely do. And we appreciate your coming on the program here. Last month, Republican Secretary of State Ruth Johnson proposed an administrative rule change that would mandate public disclosure of donors behind so-called issue ads. These are the ads that don't explicitly say who to vote for or who not to vote for, and they constitute a significant percentage of the political ads out there. Where do you stand on disclosure of funding for issue ads?
Well, first and foremost, as we deal with our campaign's finance reform package, I want to make sure, above all, we are keeping transparency as the paramount issue here. And I think the bill that we have before us in the legislature actually hits the nail on the head for the most part. I believe the Secretary of State, while well-intentioned, really trampled people's free speech and potentially safety with her ruling. And so that's why I want to make sure the campaign finance report or the campaign finance reform bills we have, you know, make sure that we are addressing the real costs of elections and really making sure people are aware of, you know, we're transparent to them. That's why as we double the contribution limits in this bill, we're tripling reporting requirements. And as it relates specifically to issue ads, I was proud to offer an amendment that got adopted in committee that would require an entity paying for those issue ads to disclose themselves as the ones that paid for them. I think that's certainly fair while still protecting people's rights to free speech.
It's a free speech issue primarily for you. If the individual donors, however, are not disclosed, a lot of people are not going to view this as a realistic compromise. What do you say to those critics?
Well, you know, I don't think we need to compromise transparency when we're dealing with this, but we do need to respect people's free speech and their participation in the political process. You know, it's as we deal with some controversial issues, there actually can become a safety issue and a privacy issue. We saw
how so? You know, how safety? That surprised me. How might safety be involved in this?
Sure. You start disclosing these donors, and all of a sudden, there's targets on these people. You know, you go to a website, and there's it's an automatic hit list. Additionally, we saw the IRS target specific donors to, like a Tea Party organization. That's very real, and that's very possible should we enact what Ruth Johnson with the Secretary of State is asking us to do. That's why I think it is a reasonable compromise that the public know the organization that is behind each of these ads. And I think knowing that gives these ads credibility that they deserve, or something to brush off is really not, not something that has any weight behind it or merit behind it.
You really fear, though, you really fear that if a person is, person's identity is disclosed as having contributed to a particular campaign, that it could reach the point where their safety is actually compromised. I mean, we all expect backlash to certain political positions and political opinions. You actually take that to the level of fearing for someone's personal safety.
I think that threat is very real, and it's possible, and just the possibility that it exists could prevent people from participating in this process, and that would be very unfortunate.
Now, this bill also doubles contribution limits for both individuals and PACs. This will affect probably only a small fraction of the most affluent political donors. According to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, just 820 Michiganders gave the maximum amount in the 2010 governor's race. Why is it important to increase political contribution limits?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I believe that we, while we are increasing limits that have not been increased since 1977, Mark, that's before I was born, by the way. You know, the cost of these campaigns has increased exponentially. Had we gone with the rate of inflation, these limits would have been 50% more than what we're proposing here today. So we wanted to make sure that we are recognizing the cost of elections today, but still being reasonable with the limits that we're setting. So I think this meets that mark. And additionally, with these contribution limits, with the increase in contribution limits, we're also tripling the transparency by ensuring that candidate committees have to now report on the off-year elections three times a year.
So this bill would double the contributions while keeping the funders of the issue ads anonymous. What do you say to critics who fear that all this additional money put into politics will simply lead to greater expectations from the donors once their person gets into office?
I think the best way to limit money in politics is to limit the size of scope of government. This bill doubles the limits, triples the transparency, and requires that issue ads, the responsible paying party of issue ads, are disclosed. And I think that's what the public deserves.
What do you make of the claim that there's from many people across the political spectrum that there's simply already too much money in politics?
I think, again, if you want to get rid of the money in politics, we need to make sure that we reduce the size and scope of government. That's the simplest way to keep special interests out of the process. But we also have to balance that with allowing people their free speech and their participation in the process as well.
Is there a point? We're talking with State Representative Lisa Postumus Lyons, chair of the State House Education and Ethics and Elections Committees. Is there a point at which you could conceivably become concerned over the amount of money in politics?
I haven't seen that as of yet. I think we have a great system here in our democratic process where it costs, the ugly truth is it costs money to run elections and to run a campaign, but nothing, especially in my experience, nothing beats hard work and grassroots efforts. The grassroots have a voice, and they make it known, and there's power at the grassroots level. And so I think we have to make sure that we keep that balance, and I think this bill still provides that.
Have you spoken with the governor's office on this? Do you have any idea what he is supporting or what he will support?
Yeah, they've got some changes that they're interested in making, and I actually think they make perfect sense. So I expect to, I expect there to be some discussion on disclosing the responsible party for robocalls, and I expect a big part of the discussion over in the House is as it relates to this bill is the issue of caucus committees spending money in primaries. That will be an issue that may change throughout the process.
And where do you stand on that?
You know, I supported it initially, and as I kind of thought through it, what it really means, there are good arguments on both sides. First and foremost, caucus committees are the only entity that is prohibited from participating in a certain election, and so that's a large argument to remove that restriction. But at the same time, those caucus committees exist to help the caucus, and it can make the difference of maintaining a majority for the Republicans or the Democrats trying to take the majority away. And if you're spending that in a primary, there's less incentive for incumbents and candidates to take care of themselves. And I think that's a very weighty decision. So I expect that to be discussed further, and I'm actually leaning towards making sure that we are protecting the caucus as opposed to individual candidates.
Before we move on to education, just let me ask you about the timeline on this measure. We're down to a relatively few number of days left in the session. When do you expect action on the campaign finance front?
Yeah, I expect action this week so that we can get it enacted before we break for the Christmas season and enter into a new year. We've got 3 session days left, and we've been, it's kind of been on the radar here for a while, for the last several weeks, and I think we can get that moving.
Let's move on to the reading proposal and these education proposals. The reading proposal would intensify efforts to teach reading prior to the third grade, but then it would hold kids back who are not at a third grade reading level in the third grade, as determined by the MEEP test, the standardized MEEP test. It would also exempt some students with learning disabilities and English as a second language students. You support this measure? Can you tell us why?
I firmly support the measure. We have a third of our kids in Michigan are not reading proficiently, and if we send them on, to continue their education journey without that fundamental foundation of reading, I think we're doing them a great disservice. We have, as you mentioned, there are good cause exemptions in the legislation that would prohibit retention. There are also, with regard to the assessments that used, while it is stated in the bill, the proficiency is determined in the state assessments. We also have a couple other options. Examples, schools can use their own reading assessments. I know my kids' public school uses Dibbles to measure how proficient and how proficient the kids are. They can also have students do a reading portfolio instead. So we're trying to provide different options. Right now, we also have an amendment on the bill, and I think this is very important, to make sure that the department, the MDE, does not require assessments for students on subjects like social studies until after third grade, so that there can be a more emphasis in our classrooms on the reading component. Additionally, the bill is tie-barred to a Representative Stallworth bill that sets out early intervention and establishes programs to help those kids kind of catch up. We want retention to be the last resort, but at the same time, we don't want to move kids forward that don't have the foundation of reading. Up until third, I have a second and a third grader, so I'm kind of knee-deep immersed in this, as a parent. And up until third grade, these kids are really working to learn to read. And after third grade, it's really they are reading to learn, and we want to make sure our kids are ready for that.
I see Representative Stallworth is also proposing, he wants interventions strengthened, which is part of this package, but he also wants, tools to engage intervention at home. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I expect to see, as it goes through the process on the House floor or over in the Senate, I expect to be there some parental involvement components. And, we're still trying to work through what the details of that would mean. If a parent is insistent upon moving their child forward, recognizing that they aren't proficient in reading, we want to make sure that parent, has some accountability as well, all parties, the teacher, the parent, the student, and so we want to make sure that we're addressing that as well.
Are you confident you can wade through all of these wrinkles in this legislation in just 3 session days?
I want to make sure we're doing this the right way as opposed to a quick way. If it's not ready by the time we leave session on Thursday, then I think that's okay. We've done a lot of education reforms, and there's no one silver bullet. It's a culmination of different reforms that ensure quality and our students are prepared. But of all of them, this issue, I believe, has the potential to be the most transformational for individual students that we've done. And so I want to do it right.
What's your understanding of the approach that Michigan schools take now with regard to elementary students who are not reading at the levels they should be? How often are they held back? How often does social promotion simply take over?
That's a good question. All schools operate differently in this, and currently it's the parents who have the final say in the retention aspect, or whether the kids move on. I can speak from personal experience. I have a third grader who's very, very good at reading and, is reading above grade level. And I have a second grader who struggles and is just a little below or barely at benchmark for her grade level. And our school has this early intervention tool that she goes into a reading class and has special emphasis on that to help her get to where she needs to be. And a lot of schools do these, and a lot of schools don't. And so we want to make sure that with Stallworth's bill, that we have the tools out there for all schools to utilize.
You are the sponsor of the proposal to grade school districts with an A through F letter grade, and this would replace a color-coded system. What makes this a better way to assess a school district?
Well, as a parent, I don't know what a lime green means, but I know what an A means, and I know what a B means, and I know what an F means. So it's really about, on the one hand, it's about making sure that we're being clear and concise and transparent with the parents and the public where these schools are doing, in a way that these schools are doing well. As far as how the grade is determined, this really, the color-coded system was just convoluted, and once it became enacted, we had calls from so many superintendents complaining about how the system was set up, that we had quality schools who couldn't get, any higher than a yellow, which, to find out is, a middle of the road. So we wanted to make sure we were addressing the system as well, and this system is set up, primarily on a percentage of those kids in who are proficient and a percentage of those kids who are student growth. And student growth component is absolutely critical. And so I want to, as it relates to how the system is better, number one, it's more clear and concise for parents. And number two, it gives schools a real certain target to meet, and it's based on proficiency and student growth as opposed to more subjective data points.
Very good. We have covered a lot of territory. We appreciate it a lot. Republican State Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons chairs the House Education and Ethics and Elections Committees. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. Have a good day.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. When people try to define Detroit's musical brand, they may automatically think of something like this. Then again, maybe something like this. But it's pretty unlikely they would think of music like this.
You're not the first girl who thought you broke my heart, and you probably won't be.
That is Detroit-based country star Lonnie Barron. And yes, you did hear that right. Detroit-based country. In the middle of the 20th century, the city was home to a thriving country music scene. This little-known music history of the Motor City is chronicled in the book Detroit Country Music, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with the book's author, Craig Mackey. He co-researched the work with Keith Cady. Craig had trouble defining the sound of Detroit country music. It varied greatly by artist and year, but one common factor he did point out was that the recordings were raw and loud.
One of the things that comes down to us today are the recordings that were made during those decades, and many of them were done live in the studio and without the benefits of producers who could ask a musician to play a certain way to get a different sound. Basically, the bands played like they did in the bars that they played. So there were a lot of very loud, energetic records made in the studios back then.
So how did there end up being such a strong country music scene during this time period in Detroit?
I think the answer to that is with the auto companies. They were offering low-skilled jobs like crazy, and when things weren't going well in the South, a lot of people came north to get jobs in Detroit. And sometimes if one member of a family could get into a plant, they would send for the rest of their families to come, and a lot of smaller communities from rural areas relocated into Southeast Michigan's cities, such as Detroit, Pontiac, Flint, and so on.
Craig, the artists that you cover in the book, they're really some characters, like Chief Redbird, who yeah. sent traditional Native American headdresses to every president. How did the chief end up in Detroit?
He lived a fascinating life, in my opinion. Born in Oklahoma Territory in 1899, he was a member of the first cowboy string band to broadcast on radio in Oklahoma. When he joined Billy McGinty's Oklahoma Cowboys, someone named Otto Gray was running the band by that time. And Gray seemed pretty ambitious. He got them onto vaudeville circuits, and they were playing radio stations across the Midwest and the Northeast. When Chief Redbird signed with NBC Artist Management in the early 30s, they wound up sending him to Cleveland for a while, and then he eventually moved the group to Detroit. I believe that Redbird got into tool and die making. That was his day job in Detroit through the 40s while he entertained at night. So I guess both the musical and the opportunity to make money during the day and have a decent living made Detroit quite attractive to many musicians.
Another pair of artists that really stood out in the book were the York Brothers. It's Leslie and George, and their 1939 track, Hamtramck Mama, was a big hit. But it was also a bit of a controversy, so much so that the mayor at the time, he tried to ban the song. First off, what's going on in Hamtramck at the time that it has that kind of reputation that a song would even be written about it?
During Prohibition, Hamtramck was a place that was sort of wide open to bootlegging and all kinds of craziness. I guess the reputation followed it or lasted from the 20s through 39 or so when Leslie York wrote the song. Hamtramck had a pretty wild reputation during those years.
About you talking, mama, boys, I've got one. She's a Hamtramck baby and she has her fun. She's a Hamtramck mama. And she sure does know her stuff. She's the hottest thing in town. Oh, Lordy, how she can love. She does the boogie and the
York Brothers came to Detroit in around 38 or 39, and they were playing two acoustic guitars. Leslie played lead, and George played rhythm. And their music had a lot of blues to it. In fact, some of the records are printed with Hillbilly Blues on the labels.
Hmm.
The Delmore Brothers were also a very popular brother duo at the time, and they sang a lot of blues, but their records were more refined than the York Brothers. The York Brothers when they got into the studio, they just let it all hang out, and there's some whooping and hollering and some distorted electric guitars going on. Once they got a bass player in there, got even more rambunctious on some of their records, and they recorded 20-some records just in Detroit before they joined the Navy in 44. They were really, from what I could tell from our interviews and people who remember them, they were very popular in Detroit, probably one of the most popular acts when they were around.
What about female artists? Were there any ladies at the time who were big on the Detroit scene?
In the 50s, there was a singer named May Hawks who came up from Tennessee. She married a man who was working in a factory, and she lived in Troy. May Hawks was a great talent.
Sweetheart, I'm tired of roaming, and I want to settle down. I'm tired of gallivanting and painting up the town. I'm tired of all the other guys, my darling, you were right. So meet me down in Nashville at the Opry tonight.
Before she wound up in singing in Detroit, she was, she started singing in Saginaw with Casey Clark and Little Jimmy Dickens at a station in 47 or 48. And when Dickens went from there to Nashville, he found out that the radio station WSM that hosts the Grand Ole Opry was looking for someone to sing as the embodiment of Little Miss Martha White. So she spent a couple years down there singing on the radio at WSM and on the Grand Ole Opry before she came back to Detroit and spent probably about 15 years singing around town.
Detroit is known as a city of music. Do you hope that this book helps to extend that brand of music for Detroit to include country?
One of the objectives that I had in putting this together was to encourage people who are interested in this music. I know that when I first started doing this research, I was playing music myself on the side, and I was... it was real inspirational for me to sit and jam with some of these musicians we spoke with and learn things from them. And I hope that some people can read this and say, hey, you know, this did go on here, and maybe it still does. Like, actually, it does. It still does. And I'm hoping that people can look through the book and learn a few things about local history and also maybe be inspired by the stories.
Craig Mackey is a writer, musician, researcher, and radio host. His book, which he co-researched with Keith Cady, is Detroit Country Music, Mountaineers, Cowboys, and Rockabillies. Craig, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Making believe
for Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
That you still love me, it's leaving me alone and so blue. But I'll always dream. Still, I'll never own you.
That's Detroit-based country artist Jimmy Work, and the track is called Making Believe. Current State here on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan's western Upper Peninsula is known for its rugged beauty, freezing weather, and copper. Copper mining's a way of life in the UP, whose tradition goes back more than a century. And it was a century ago that one of the darkest episodes in the history of copper country played out in the small town of Calumet. On Christmas Eve, 1913, hundreds of striking miners and their families were attending a holiday party in a building called Italian Hall. Someone yelled fire, but there was no fire. Panic ensued, and 73 people were killed in a stampede for the door. Michigan author Steve Leto has written about the tragedy, and he's also featured in an upcoming PBS documentary, Red Metal, The Copper Country Strike of 1913, which airs here on WKAR-TV Tuesday, December 17th. Steve Leto joins us now in the studio to talk about the Italian Hall disaster of 1913. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. When did you first learn of the story of the Italian Hall disaster of 1913?
I don't know. And by that, I mean it's something I've always known about.
Yeah.
I grew up in a Finnish community with a Finnish family, and more than half the victims were Finns. And this is the kind of thing that in our community, it's beyond legend, it's beyond myth. It's something that I think almost all of us are born knowing about. Mm.
Did you grow up in the UP?
Well, my family's from up there, but they moved to Lansing right before I was born. I've got five brothers who were born in Hancock. So I just missed being a Uper by about a year.
How about that? And you were compelled to write a book about this.
Yeah, you know, I went to law school. I have a degree in history. Afterwards, I was practicing law, and one day I saw a reference to the Italian Hall in another book. And I thought, you know, it's been so long. Maybe somebody's written a good book about this. Nobody had. So it was time for someone to start looking into it.
Some background here. Calumet sits on the Keweenaw Peninsula way up north in the UP. It's in the heart of copper country, and in 1913, about 9,000 copper miners were on strike against the Calumet and Hecla Mining Company, known as C&H. Why were the miners on strike?
Mining was a brutal business back then. On average, one man died per week in the mines, just week in, week out. A man would die, and there'd be 10 serious injuries for every man who died, and that was business as usual. And the miners actually thought, you know, there should be safer conditions. Perhaps we could have a shorter work day, maybe slightly higher wages. And so it's a lot of the same things you hear workers complain about nowadays, except the working conditions in particular really underscored what they were upset about. So socialism was what they were accused of following, but in reality they simply wanted to unionize. And that was the big thing they fought over, was getting their union recognized. And that was the thing that the mines dug their heels in on and refused to do, despite the fact that the strike dragged on for months. They never recognized the union during the entire strike.
So set the scene for us here. Christmas Eve, 1913. There's a party in the Italian Hall in Calumet. Set the scene for us.
It was a party for the children. The strike had dragged on for months. And so the women's auxiliary thought, you know, the kids aren't going to have a good Christmas, and that's a shame. You know, the adults can squabble all they want, but the kids need a Christmas. So they put together a party for the children of the striking miners in the upper floor of a building called the Italian Hall. And at the height of that party, Christmas Eve, 1913, someone came into the building from the outside and yelled fire. And the evidence is pretty clear that he did that just to break the party up. He may not have been intending to kill people, but he was certainly intending to cause chaos. And in the ensuing stampede to get out of the building, 73 people died on the steps of that building. There's a very, very steep staircase to get from the upper floor to the bottom floor. And of those 73 deaths, 60 were children and more than half were Finns.
And really, the bottleneck was the front door of the building, correct?
Well, no, that's the thing. There's a legend about the doors. And for many, many years, people have said that the doors opened the wrong way. And I did some research on this because I found a photograph that had never been published before. It's on the cover of my book.
Whoa.
That shows that the doors
opened. What a find.
Yeah, it shows the doors opened the correct way. And I got the marker changed. The marker had been on the site for years saying the doors opened the wrong way. And I was in Lansing a couple years ago, and a woman came up to me, and she handed me a card and said, "I understand you think there's a mistake in one of my markers." And she was in charge of the marker program. And I developed a friendship with her, and it got to the point where she asked me to rewrite the language for the marker, and we got the marker changed this past summer.
So the doors opened out.
They opened correctly, yeah.
Out onto the street, but it was still too many people.
Trying to get down a steep flight of stairs many children in the mix.
Yeah. Where was the first place your research took you? And tell us about your methodology in writing this
book. Well, interestingly enough, because of the copper country, there's the Michigan Tech University. Michigan Tech's got this huge archive about the copper industry. And years ago, people started donating stuff to them about the copper country, the copper companies. So Calumet and Hecla, for instance, all their papers were donated to these archives. And there's a huge wealth of information there. Also in the Lansing archives, the Governor Ferris papers. Woodbridge Ferris was the governor during the strike. He tried to end the strike, and he couldn't, but he gathered up all his papers and donated them to the state. So at the Michigan State Archives, there's some great, great documents.
Did you dig into these documents deeper than anybody before you?
I believe so, yeah. I was neck deep in these papers for quite a while at both those archives and other archives as well.
What was that like? I mean, did your background as an attorney really prepare you for a project like this, or was it really an eye-opener in other ways?
Well, that's an interesting point, because other historians had looked at this story. but none of them had looked at the legal documents the way that I looked at them. So there was a coroner's inquest where there's a transcript that, you know, question and answer, question and answer. Other people had seen it, but no one else noticed one of the things that I noticed, for instance, and that was the coroner brought in people who didn't speak English and didn't give them interpreters. And he made them answer questions in English, despite the fact that they barely could.
Oh, my.
And I noticed it immediately because I'm an attorney and I would have brought in interpreters for people who don't speak English. And the fact that the coroner did that indicates that the coroner was trying to cover this up. There's other evidence that he was doing that also. But it was just a bizarre thing that jumped out at me. But I was not the first person to look at this transcript. I was the first person to spot that, though.
Can we assume the coroner was in cahoots with the mining company then?
It's not that he was in cahoots with them, but they had common interests. So in other words, he definitely wanted to make them happy.
Mm-hmm.
And he definitely knew that this was going to probably make the mines look bad if it came out that the man who yelled fire was a strike breaker. And I believe he was. And there's a lot of evidence that he was. And the mines had brought in these guys from outside the area who were hired muscle and basically turned them loose on the community and said, as long as you're beating up strikers, we don't care what you do. And these guys wouldn't get arrested for anything.
Your book was first published in 2006, but last June a second edition came out in which you actually name the alleged culprit who shouted fire.
You don't need to say alleged because he's probably dead now.
You are an attorney, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I am.
Will you indulge us or do we have to read the book to find out?
No, I can tell you, but I try to summarize it here. But basically what happened as the rescuers responded to the call to the situation at the Italian Hall, they started pulling people out of the stairwell, many of them injured, many of them dead. And in the midst of all these people, they pulled out a strike breaker. And there's no reason a strike breaker would have been in that party. He wouldn't have been welcome in that party. He probably would have gotten beaten up if he'd gone into the party, but he was in the pile. And he had an alibi that is so unlikely that no one would believe it in a million years. And then you ask yourself, why would you make up a crazy alibi unless you were trying to cover up something else? So I explained that there's a very strong circumstantial case that it was a strike breaker and we know his name. And I do explain that in the book and give all the details. And you're free to not believe it, but most people I've shown it to say, you know, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Edward Manley.
Edward Manley.
Yeah.
This tragedy took place in 1913.
Yeah.
During a time when organized labor movements were growing around the world, including what would soon be known as the Soviet Union. The Russian Revolution was just 4 years off. Is it far-fetched to speculate that the mine management was reading the writing on the wall and was trying to squash what they saw as the start of communism in their midst?
Well, they actually used the phrase socialism a lot, but they used it in that time frame the same way that they used the phrase communism in the 60s, okay? I mean, when I was growing up, I remember people talking about, oh, the communists are coming, the communists.
Ooh, that stigma existed for socialism 100 years ago.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so mine management would actually talk. They gave interviews, and they'd say, well, these socialists are doing this. And they were clearly using it as an insult, but also as a description of somebody who's anti-American. You are anti-American. And to them, big business thought, capitalism is as patriotic as you can get. The love of money is the love of the country.
We're down to 30 seconds or so, but tell us about your participation in this PBS documentary.
I was a historical consultant on a documentary called Red Metal, The Copper Country Strike of 1913. And I consulted with the filmmakers before they even started doing anything, followed along the entire process. And I also appear in the film quite a bit. So I'm extremely excited because they did a wonderful job of telling the story of the strike and putting it in context. For people to understand why it's not just a local story, but it's actually something that everyone should know about.
And that comes up, you can see that Tuesday, December 17th on WKAR-TV. We want to thank author Steve Leto, the author of Red Metal, The Copper Country Strike of 1913. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Take a trip with me in 1913. To Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, and the miners are having their big Christmas ball.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Imagine you were an 18-year-old American student and you went off to study at a university in China that taught economics, biology, and all the other subjects in Chinese. Then imagine on top of that navigating the legal and cultural differences to start your own business. For most of us, it would be a daunting challenge to say the least, and more likely just too difficult to even attempt. But at Michigan State University, some Chinese international students are up to the challenge. The number of businesses owned by Chinese international students has grown with the Chinese student population. In 2006, there were fewer than 600 Chinese international students at MSU. Today, there are more than 4,000. Current State's Yensia Wang shares why some of these students are taking their experience abroad beyond the classroom.
Workers of the Oriental Mart on Grand River in East Lansing are cutting vegetables and packaging meat to stock the shelves. The store's owner, Ko Bowen, keeps up with the busy traffic, monitoring inventory, meeting with employees, and jumping back to the register if customers line up. A store owner by day, Bowen has another identity.
I'm currently still in school, but I take last year off. I'm in supply chain major.
But Bowen hadn't let his lack of a diploma stifle his entrepreneurial spirit. In addition to the Oriental Mart, Bowen also owns the Great China Market on Trowbridge Road. And 3 years ago, he opened his first local business, Street 8 Bookstore, on Grand River, after being denied a part-time cafeteria job on campus.
One time I want to sell back my textbook, they gave me a lower, they gave me a very cheap. I think I can do that too and do a better job than them. So later on, we ran the bookstore.
Bowen is not alone. Other Chinese MSU students have opened karaoke lounges, restaurants, and even a car dealership.
Since I was a freshman, then I remember my first car is a Dodge Caliber.
That is Hua Qiang, a senior accounting major at MSU from Shanghai. Today, he's inspecting a 2011 Honda Accord that he hopes to add to his inventory at his dealership called the Spartan Auto Collection. He started his business after losing $2,000 when trading in his car to a local dealer.
So, like, why not I open a dealership that I can drive any car I want.
Opening a business in a foreign country might seem daunting while in school, but to Peter Briggs, the director of MSU's Office of International Students and Scholars, Chinese students opening businesses is not a surprise.
Last year we had 2,800 Chinese undergraduates and about 800 Chinese graduate students. So with that number, it's understandable that a certain number are going to be creative and proactive and seeing opportunities and wanting to do something about it.
But being an international student adds some unique challenges. As Briggs explains, maintaining legal status while running a business can be tricky for those ambitious Chinese students.
Student visa does allow you to own a business. That's okay. But the student visa doesn't allow you to work for that business unless you have special permission. So you have to get what we call curricular practical training or optional practical training in order to be authorized to work off campus.
International students are only allowed to work on campus for a limited 20 hours a week during the school year with their student visa. Curriculum practical training allows students to work off campus while they are still in school. Once they graduate, however, they have to obtain what's called optional practical training in order to work part-time or full-time jobs. Peter Briggs again.
What good business person would ever own a business and open a business and then not work for it? And so it's a little bit hard to imagine that the students wouldn't really be, frankly, violating their student visas while they're working for their businesses, even though I think by law they are probably telling people that, no, I'm not working for the business.
Another challenge for foreign-born business owners, Bowen says, is building working relationships with local employees.
I think the main part is communicate with the local, you know, co-worker. That's really important. You have to show them you are professional to run the business. Otherwise, why they want to work for you?
Some Chinese students receive financial support from their parents who are thousands of miles away. That's how Hua Qiang got the startup money for his car dealership.
I was asking those kind of money for half a year because they did not trust me. Like, I can open, the business here.
There is a perception at MSU that some Chinese students come from wealth, and parents' financial support to open businesses just adds to that stereotype. That is also what Peter Briggs, the director of Office of International Students and Scholars, says he worries about.
If you see some very expensive cars and they're driven by Chinese students, that people jump to the wrong conclusion that all Chinese students are rich. And I think there are some students here who are rich, yes. But I think it's still a lot of middle-class Chinese students who are here that this is still expensive to pay out-of-state tuition and cover all their bills here.
Nie Xibei, another Chinese student, is Bowman's business partner at the Street A bookstore. Having managed it for 3 years, he feels that through experience, he has realized his full potential, including gaining confidence in himself and making his family see him differently.
Before I came here, my father called me like useless. They can just offer me the first year's tuition.
But in 3 years, he has been able to cover his own expenses, including tuition, rent, and a car payment. He also bought his mom a Tiffany ring and a Cadillac XTS. Besides his financial success, Xibei has built a reputation among many Chinese students at MSU.
They call me teacher, master, like that. So I teach them like how the business run.
However, Xibei's Street A bookstore partner, Ko Bowen, is not ready to consider himself a master.
You can't think about me doing a good job here because I took over others' business. They are successful already. So if 5 years later, 3 years later, I still run the store and become a better store, at that time you can say, oh, you are doing really good on your business.
But for Bowen, Xibei, Huaqiang, and other Chinese students at MSU who have attempted to start businesses, building a better store seems like extra credit. For when it comes to taking the giant leap from college student to business owner, all while living in a foreign country, these students seem to have earned a well-deserved A for their effort. For Current State, this is Yan Jiewang.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Pasadena hasn't been on the MSU football itinerary since 1988. And in 23 days, that will change with a Spartan Rose Bowl date with Stanford here to talk about the game that made it possible, Saturday night's exhilarating contest with Ohio State. WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on radio and television. Good to see you, Al.
How you doing, Mark? Good morning.
You were there? I just want to let you talk about it.
Well, I tell you, when you and I talked before, we just hit the air now, and unbelievable moment. You know, for being down there on that field, I mean, we were sitting in the press box, us media members, and it really didn't hit us that MSU, you know, booked the ticket to the Rose Bowl until we saw, even on that 4th-and-2 with Nico Salen with the stop, it didn't hit us until Langford ran in up the middle late in that game that they're going to the Rose Bowl. And it was a kind of a cool moment because we all looked at each other like, you know, kind of smirking like MSU's going to the Rose Bowl. You almost had to pinch yourself. And then, you know, the moment after the field, I mean, I've never seen head coach Mark D'Antonio that fired up. I mean, he was so fired up, Mark. I mean, the players, tears being shed left and right, the roses in their mouth. We got a lot of footage of it, and then, you know, it's so crazy. We go into the locker room after the game, and, you know, they have a 20-minute cool-down period. During that cool-down period, you can hear the music banging from the locker room.
I saw
you know,
the
them
video.
Dancing. Oh, it was crazy. And then after that 20 minutes, we go in there, and they're still dancing for about 15 minutes until we actually interview the players. It was unbelievable stuff. We'll have that video along with some fan reaction posting on WKRI.org later on today. But, Mark, it was an incredible moment, and deservingly so. I mean, they haven't done this since 1988.
We joked here that I haven't seen D'Antonio smile so much in his entire tenure at Michigan State University put together as I did
right.
I did on Saturday.
Yeah, he
night.
Showed those pearly whites a lot.
That's right.
Night.
More than I'm used to. In 5 years, what do you think you'll remember from Saturday?
Wow, I tell you what, you know, for me, you know, it was. Me being a reporter, being unbiased, of course, coming in there and just covering the game, it was hard for me to contain myself. myself to a degree because I am an MSU alum. And just seeing, for me, seeing the emotion from those players, I mean, seeing guys like Max Bulla, I mean, hug one another and tell these players are telling each other, oh, I love you, man, we finally did it. I mean, and to see the tears, the amount of tears from these different players, and it just showed, you know, the camaraderie. It shows the hard work. It was a moment where this team has been working for this for over two decades. And now to finally get to this point, the Rose Bowl, one of the biggest stages in college football, arguably the biggest other than the national championship, and to finally get there was something unbelievable, Mark.
The momentum shifted noticeably from Michigan State to Ohio State, back to Michigan State, yeah, which made the game so much more dramatic.
Right.
I think that's what I will remember, is just how the fortunes turned.
Oh, without a doubt. And, you know, and it was so impressive to see how resilient this Michigan State football team had been in that entire game.
I mean,
Connor Cook's confidence, even when they were down, even after when he threw the interception, I mean, that could have been a moment where completely could have shifted the game into a different momentum shifter there. But he kept his composure, he kept his confidence, and he just went out there and played football. That was so impressive. And then that defense coming up with the huge stop, they didn't give up on themselves. They knew throughout that entire game, you know, interviewing the players afterwards, they knew throughout that entire game, they never doubted themselves. And that was so big, Mark.
And you're off to Pasadena?
Yes. We will be covering the Rose Bowl, so we'll have a lot of coverage from that. Again, we'll have still the post-game fan reaction. That'll be on WKR.org from that Big Ten championship win later on.
Lots on the Rose Bowl to keep track of on Current Sports with Al Martin on WKAR Radio and TV. Thanks, Al.
Hey, no problem, Mark.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore.